Guys, this is an oral history interview with Mustaqim Khirdin. It is today the 17th of August and we're at his offices in Customs House. Now, my first question is, how did you get involved in Antarctica and the islands?
When I started here in 1990, I'm a freak for adventure. And I saw this red bug leaving from P500, I can remember. And the guys were going there, and I always asked myself, what do I need to do to go there? Because that looks very interesting. They go and then you see them only in a while again. But I wasn't aware of what they were doing, and then I started investigating. And then I came about here at the top, and they said, no, that's for the islands, but obviously with an old dispensation and everything, and said, no, you are colored, you cannot go, and all of this. This is how it used to be. And I said, no, I need to challenge this. And I started writing letters, and I want to go, and I'm the best at what I do, and blah, blah. At that time, I was a plumber. So I said, I'm the best plumber you can get in South Africa. You put me out one competition, say, this company and that company that I've actually entered into. And then I started that process. And then my first opportunity, that is how I started, because I saw it. And my first opportunity actually. And then I was chosen because they got a decree from head office. Because then it was change of government. And they said, no, we need to have more representativity. And then they looked at who the first probable and possible person is that they could really just take in. And then my name popped up.
Nice.
That was in 94, but then on that same year, I was banned for 10 years because I was too political on the... And that is how they claim, that I was too political. But I came on to... And that was in Antarctica. We were busy constructing Sena 4. And then I realized that everything was just being done from one side. There was just instruction. And if people worked until they were half dead, then all that would happen is they would go to the ship or they would be sent to the ship, and then a new, fresh bunch of guys would come. And then I challenged that. And I said, but that's not right. We need to have a meeting. And at least once a week in the morning, we're going to have a meeting to listen to what it is that you have that might be nagging you. It could be a mental condition, it could be a health condition, it could be anything. It's just about what we're doing. And then that meetings are still being held on a Wednesday morning.
Nice.
In Antarctica from that time. But then they said no, that they're not looking for somebody that is going to rally the troopies. Now they're in another direction. They want the troopies to be rallied in the direction that is only work oriented. So
how did they... Is it because the sun shines so long?
24/7.
24/7, and they just work people to the bone.
Yeah, I must admit that I have sometimes now, with myself being a group leader, I also have sometimes the same, because I can realize the method behind the madness.
Yeah.
To get that work done in that short space of time because the ship is leaving. So I tend to move towards that as well when I'm in Antarctica.
But what happened? Did they like have an official inquiry before they banned you?
No. You see, management at that time was the be all, see all, and be all, and it all, and everything was. If they decided, listen, we don't need you there, they don't need you there. They don't need to come to South Africa and say, listen, we need to now, like we have processes now that you need to go through and say, okay, fine. Why is it that he's not there? No, they just decide, listen, you are not fit for the activities there, so we put you off. And funny enough, I went back in 2004, not as a layman, but as a group leader.
Yes. So you've been a group leader for quite a while.
From 2004.
From 2004. What can you remember about your first voyage itself?
The first thing that came to mind when we started eating the high seas was, what the hell did I get myself into? Because then I started praying, are we going to, if you see, you come out of your cabin and there was rough guys that worked on the ship. So they didn't take anything, you know, like you can't be sick or anything. They will be on top of you when you were a baby and stuff like that. But for me, you come outside towards the back, I think it's the off deck, and I saw a wall of water that stood upright like Table Mountain, and I went inside again, and I swear I took all my insides and I put it up to the
No.
And I thought, nah, what did I get myself into? And I started praying, and when we came to Antarctica, I saw this big band of ice. And I thought to myself, these people are saying we're going through there, but how the hell can you go through there with a ship when it's not water?
Yeah.
No, but I mean, that kind of experience, it definitely put me in a frame where I was very close to my spiritual self. And then you sort of, now you start doing a lot of introspection, because look at this, look at where I am, look at how I see things differently now. Because I saw a bird coming in, it's called a swamp beetle. And I was at all this clothes on, and I was still getting cold. I saw this little bird coming in singing. And they said, no, he normally comes when the storm is about to come on. And I thought to myself, look at that small little bird. He's got nothing on. Except for his down that he's got on, but he's got nothing on him. And look at the eye
again.
So it was like, that was my first real experience. Yeah.
You said you were, that was 94, so were you the only so-called colored person during
the
trip?
No. Even before that, there was one or two that I can remember that has ever gone there being colored or black, for that matter. But I was most definitely the first Muslim to go.
Oh.
The very, very first.
First Muslim to go. How was
and
that?
The only one.
Oh.
And another colleague of mine.
Okay.
So you're saying, how was it?
So how was that? I don't know, are you practicing Muslim?
Yes.
So
I don't know what that means, practicing Muslim. I know in the West it's are you practicing or not practicing, because you're not a Muslim or you're not.
The ship never leaves during Ramadan, right? Or does it sometimes?
Yes, it's leaving now the last week.
So what do you do?
You keep on going. When you're on the ship, in our religion, the provision is made for when you travel. So when you travel, you eat. Because your body needs to be sustained in a certain way for you to be able to cope with that travel. And then when you come to land again, you just pay back in the days that you've lost. Or otherwise, what you can do is you give the alms to the poor, that would feed one family per every day that you've lost out on. So you will say, okay, to feed a family would be about 80 rand. So if I've lost 5 days, it would be 400 rand that I need to pay in and give to alms. And I don't have to pay it in fasting again.
So even
and they distribute it to the...
Because I'm thinking during the construction of Sinai, at least there must have been times where the ship went down during Ramadan, and I mean there the sun doesn't really set, so...
And then that applies.
Ah, interesting. Okay, how exactly does PWD slot in with Sana? What's your mandate? What must you do?
Firstly,
from who do you take orders?
PWD, NDPW. Our mandate is to be custodian of all government buildings in South Africa. We are the custodian thereof. We construct, the custodian thereof. After which we give it to clients. Now the clients are varied. It will be from the presidency, right through to the Department of Environmental Affairs, which is it's known as now. So each client has a specific need. This client, the need for this client from us in terms of our mandate is to construct building structures that will house scientific personnel for their needs so that they can. So we are critical in the provision of scientific research bases on these three islands. So what happens is the client will say, we need a new base, or the base is starting to go, or you know what, the old base has now crumbled, the snow has taken over, we need a new base, then we start the design process. And so let's design a new one, right? terms of the design, who needs to have a say into it in terms of use? Okay. The end user always has a say.
So when they constructed the new Marion base and the new Sinai base as well, did you have a say in who's going to be the engineers, the architect?
We appoint.
Did you appoint them?
In terms of the design, we appoint. Mm. In DPW, because we carry that mandate from government, we appoint. So what happens is the client says, okay, this is our need. We need to house 80 personnel over a year or over a takeover, and we need to accommodate for at least 15 to 20 personnel over the year, the overwintering period. This is what they require in terms of these studies that they need to exercise, and this is what is required during a takeover. Then we do what we call, we do an appointment. Mm. We ask for an appointment of various professionals who will see to that kind of need. Mm. First thing they do is they do a space and cost norm. And then we say, okay, fine, this in terms of the space is in terms of cost, what it will cost.
Cost, okay.
And then we draft all of that and collectively put it forward to the client, and the client says we can or we cannot budget for it.
Oh, I understand.
And then the process starts, and then when they say they can budget, and then those professionals that we've appointed, we normally put them in a management position to oversee the process. Yes. So, okay, fine, this was the design, I oversee that the design goes as such.
So did you have joint committees once the process has started? Do you sometimes have joint committees where, say for instance, Henry Valentine sits on the committee, you sit
absolutely
on a committee, and then you decide
absolutely
together?
That is part of the procurement.
Okay.
Yes, definitely. Look, the client is always a representative on all of the committees, okay, so that we don't lose the line that the client wishes to have at the end of the project. So the client will always, okay, that's the need. And sometimes during the project, that's the beauty of the field that I'm in. It changes direction, but you still come out at its goal.
Oh.
It changes a bit of direction because all of a sudden it moves from 80 to 100 people, and then you have to increase, and that carries an increased cost.
Stuff.
So, you know, things like that. But
it's quite a tricky management story as well.
You have to know. That's why we've got Project 2000 that we work on. So you don't lose track. We've got a baseline that you work on.
Okay. How important do you think is in DPW to Sanab?
I think it's critical that in DPW, if we've done a basic variance between ourselves as custodian and what it would cost if we had put our function out into the private sector, we being in the public sector, and we've realized that for a simple, even a takeover, the cost would be at least 9.5 times the amount of money that it costs us to do this, the same amount of work. And then also with us, you have spin-offs, whereas in the private sector, you're not guaranteed of spin-offs. Spin-offs in the sense that I've spoken to you earlier about training, getting people trained, people qualified. That person can feed his family once he becomes a plumber, once he becomes a... We've got that kind of spin-off. In the public sector, where that spin-off is not guaranteed
in the
private sector. In the private sector, you will get people who are qualified that will be employed, and that increases the costs, whereas we are able to maintain that all the time.
Okay. Speaking about training, where do you recruit your personnel from?
Our personnel is recruited from our... We've got a workshop, a fully-fledged workshop that services all government buildings. We've got a maintenance section.
Mm.
So we recruit from internal. And if necessary, we do not find the resources, as I've told you earlier, the resources are depleting. And then what we do is we normally make an application to HR to go to the private sector.
Okay.
But normally that comes at a hell of a cost. And we can already see that it's creating problems.
Mm.
Because the guy that comes in from the outside that has to be appointed at a certain rate.
Mm.
And the people on the inside are not on that rate. So there's already a problem that I'm working on in terms of training now.
Mm. What do you look for in a person to do construction work on Antarctica?
Men, as a group leader, I don't question your ability in terms of your constructiveness.
Mm.
If you're a plumber, you're a plumber. I look for more than that, and I've just had interviews recently in Alpha Koch. I look for more than that. I look for people who can live with people in all aspects of the world, live with people. And then I look at your capabilities as a leader within your field, and then also as a leader within your workshop environment, and then a leader in your community, because collectively, that to me will mean that I get a well-rounded person going with me. I don't know that I can depend on somewhere, because I need to attend somewhere else. I need to see you. You have a need on the island, so I need to know that I can leave her on her own. You know, so that's what I'm looking for. The constructiveness of that person, I can always use a hammer and a chisel.
Yeah,
you know, and you can work on that, because that is bound to change all the time. Systems always change, but the person is what I'm looking for. The person that's able to say when he comes back that he's had a good time, he's had a full experience, and that he's gained the knowledge that was necessary on the trip.
What is the specific challenges, and I suppose you'll have to take it island by island and then Antarctica, of working on Marion Island?
Those extreme conditions.
That's broad. Are you talking about weather, or are you talking about people?
Both. Whatever comes.
The biggest challenge is people. The biggest challenge is people. And why I say that is, people come with moods. Now, I've learned to leave moods at home when I go on a trip. You see the same person, that's it. I'll cry on my own and I'll talk to myself on my own, but you see the same person, and that's important to the other person. Because that person, you don't know what that person feels at specific times. Or I just had an induction, you should have been there on Monday morning when I had it with the guys, because I was telling them, you might find that you don't like stink toes, but she don't like bad breath. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
To put it in literal terms. But the biggest challenge, aside from people, is also weather. You know, it retards progress in terms of constructive ability. So, for instance, on say Gough Island or Marion Island, you will get a lot of rain most of the time. Here and there, snow on Marion. So your gear, remembering that the work cannot stop, the work has to be completed. So all you do is you layer the person. Yes. And you say, listen, there's no such thing. And I just had it on Monday when I told them, listen, there's no time to get sick. You can recover when you're back on the ship. You can sleep for 3 days, not a problem. But when you're there, I don't want to hear that you're sick and you cannot get up. And unless it's extreme and the person is off. I'm going to say that. I'm going to go back to how I used to feel about it. So yeah, that's weather. Marion is mostly rain, so your kit will be more leaned towards rainproof materials. Whereas Antarctica, you don't get rain. You get beautiful snowfalls. So it's more cold that you will, because when the snowfall comes with wind, it becomes dangerous. Now its name, little snowflake, becomes an extreme danger to your skin. So the clothing changes, and with the clothing change comes a further retardation in your ability to construct.
I was just wondering, how do you construct with thick muffin?
Well, you acclimatize within about a week and a half.
Yeah.
And then you're able to hit that hammer with the same blow that you could when you were here.
The workers who go down to Antarctica and Marion, do they get overtime pay or danger pay?
They get overtime, they get all of what is due to them. But the biggest challenge to me at the time, and still is, and it's always up against the wall, is the fact that SARS does not see us. They say we go to a South African base, so we fall within that framework of earning in South African currency, whereas everyone else around you that are service providers to that industry are earning because they move outside of the 3 or 4 nautical mile radius, so they earn in international currency. So they earn in dollar. So you always find, and that is perhaps one of the reasons you find that people are leaving this industry. And they're not interested in wanting to stay. Like, for instance, our counterparts down in Tasmania, they're in the south of Australia, they earn dollars. So they earn internationally, even they earn Aussie dollars, but when they go outside their nautical mile radius, they earn in dollars.
Dollars.
Because that's how it is. That's just the law. So yeah, so they get everything, and that is still the biggest challenge for us to overcome. But we've threatened to SARS, they feel strongly that it, until such time that it changes.
Well, can SARS, it's not like you earn millions of dollars, that they're making millions off you.
Well, a couple of hundred pounds, okay.
You've been going now in 1994, and then from 2004, and it sounds like you almost went every year after that.
Almost every year.
Can you, in that time, can you see any changes in terms of the people?
There's a change on Marion. There's a collective with a goal. I see the slight change coming on in Antarctica as well. I do think that the one thing that holds back everyone in terms of progress with whatever program they're busy with is still racism. It still comes down to that. And once people can start looking past the person and looking at the ability of the person, then I think... And I'm very confident that I think we're one of the best nations. Give us 5 to 10 years.
Mm.
We're obviously going to be the best in terms of our progress and how we move forward. Because it takes time for people to look past my skin color or past my lingo or past my method of doing what I do. Mm. But getting the job done, obviously.
So would you say it's better on Marion, if I understand you correctly?
It is better on Marion, because on Marion, although they are siloed, as I feel that is perhaps one thing that I don't like about Marion, where everyone just does what they have to do and that's it, but they just need to engage with you on that and that's it, and finish and climb and they keep on going again. It's always nice to know, who knows, I might have found an interest in science, big time, and I've moved from here and moved into the science field if I had known more about what they're doing.
Mm.
So it's a bit too closed, but yet, with that having said that, Marion is a bit more open in terms of they look at you as a person, and this is your worth coming as a person, whereas Antarctica still needs to get that. But when you're in Antarctica and you talk to the Russians that pass by or the Americans that pass by, then it's like a breath of fresh air. Look at this, they come and they can talk to you for hours and they will, you know, whereas your own South African colleagues, your own countrymen, they won't even tap on that kind of knowledge that you have with you. But somebody who's a professor, who's got his PhD at Harvard, whatever, that person will find it interesting speaking to you and, you know, and saying, you know, that's in there. But, and then you always get this, pull up their faces. I think this is, we're not in the real world here. We need to compete, and I can tell you we compete big time. With everything we do, our sciences, everything, we're competing there. And in most cases, we actually come out tops, but we don't want to give that to ourselves.
You spoke now a bit about Russians and Australians and so visiting. How much exchange are there between the... Because there's quite some exchange, scientists moving from base to base, living there. But do you learn from other people on other bases? Do you sometimes visit other bases?
Oh, yes. Well, I've visited Neumeier. I'm still to go to Troll. So in terms of what I do and the command that I carry, we're always looking at systems in terms of, say, the sewage system, the water system. How does these compare to ours? And I don't use the other way around. How does ours compare to these? How does these compare to ours? Because currently we've got the most advanced scientific base in the Antarctica. Although we don't have as practical as what I would have seen it happen, like for instance at Neumeier, the German station, they've stuck to basics. And the basics are working. We've gone a bit beyond, but going beyond, it comes with a certain amount of problems because of the extreme weather condition. So your properties of your materials change. So we haven't taken that into account, but I'm trying to move back to basics. In terms of tap or whatever, you know. Little things, and yes, we do engage with each other and we go through the bases that we do visit, and then we look at what they've done that could benefit us. and then maybe look at how we can regress so that we can see, okay, fine, now the tap washer lasts a bit longer than because we've got too heavy and too intricate a design on that.
Okay. Explain just a little bit for people who would not know, which are most people, how does a day in the life of a construction worker in Antarctica proceed?
I'll tell you, it starts very early in the morning. Because you don't have night, you don't have darkness, there's no absence of light. You can start very early. And normally what I do, I take advantage of that. Sometimes you let guys work through, and I've done it in the past, I'm still doing it if it's necessary. You let guys work through 2 days, and on the third day you tell them, okay, fine, let's rest, let's go and sleep. Typically a constructive worker out in the Antarctica, one, you must be able to carry your own body weight very, very well. Because you're going to put on between 22 and 27 kilograms. And you're going to be walking in snow that drops to about, say, up to 500 millimeters. So you're going to have to lift yourself out every time you move forward. That's in the external environment.
Gosh.
Internally, it's okay because it replicates the same as what you are working here. But that's the challenge. Working in Antarctica is always challenging for a constructive worker in that sense. Because you're putting on extra weight, and now you still have to produce the same as what you have produced. The other challenge is, because of extreme cold, you might not be able to immediately register hurt or pain. So you come back to the baseline, and then you realize, but why, like this hand of mine, why is it starting to turn black? And then you realize you almost got frostbite. But when you're outside, you maybe had a tinge and you took off your glove, and now you keep on going because the coldness just deadens it quickly, and now you just keep on going, but you're not realizing what you're doing to your body. So you have to be aware of your body at all times. You have to know the condition that you're going in, and then a 4 pound hammer is not a 4 pound hammer anymore. It now becomes an 8 pound hammer, but with a 4 pound blow.
That sounds incredible.
How do you prepare the workers who go down? How do you train them? What do you teach them?
I have a method. When I go down to the Antarctica, what I do is, each person has got their own area of responsibility. Being a plumber is responsible for that. So what I do is, as we come closer, I start here, but I obviously increase it as I come closer, and I let the plumber give us a presentation on how and what it is that he will be contributing to the team in terms of what his responsibility is. And then I do the same thing all the way through, so that when we come there, it's a matter of just getting off and doing the work that needs to be done. No one needs to be told what to do and where to do it and when to do it. Everyone knows what to do. But in terms of getting them to acclimatize, I start doing that when we about, say, 2 or 3 days out. When you start realizing that the sun is not going down and it's 11 o'clock at night and 10 o'clock. So I push those presentations to that time. So I move with their body language, and they start being up later and later and later, and they're not realizing, and all of a sudden they've been awake for 2 days and they don't even know it. So that's what I do.
Quickly going back to Sana'a, I recently came across a range of articles from 1995, 1996 when it opened, that said it was painted in the old South African flag. Did you notice that in 1994 was just construction still?
That was a directive. You see, the entire design and construction was based on the old South African flag. So all of your fiberglass and your resin was made out in the old South African colors, orange, white, and blue. And then in 1994, there was a directive that came from the minister. The first thing they needed to go in terms of representing the country, which now they had a new democracy, was to change that. Because people would see that, and they would still, although you still find that attitude there, it had an impact, obviously. on people. But after that, people realize, but this is just a building. But it's just a building, but coming to that building, that impact that you would have had would have been, you know, it's like being on, and I don't know if you're rugby lovers.
No.
You go to New Orleans, or you watch on the TV, you watch at New Orleans, and you see all of these South African flags, and then in between you see one of these old South African flags.
Oh, yeah, no, I know
that. And then obviously, you might get a different feeling to me. I might get a different feeling to someone else. And then you look at it, and then I don't get cross, but I think to myself, wow, in what age do you want to find yourself?
My reaction.
You know what I'm saying?
Sort of, what on earth are you thinking?
We've moved past that, we've moved past color, we've moved past looking. What is your body?
So now, what happened?
That's
Is it still that those three colors? Or have they painted the blues?
No, they had to paint it.
And how does that go?
Well, it remains a challenge. The company that was the company that we sourced the paints from was Sigma, I can remember, and they had to...
Is it a local company or international?
It's an international company because the paint, but we are local now.
Mm.
In terms of all of us, like we try and keep it local.
Mm.
At the time, there wasn't a company in South Africa that could give us a mix of paint that could withstand that extreme cold weather. So what Sigma came out with was a paint that had to be mixed with a resin and it could retain its color.
Mm.
So that company, but for now we're sourcing it locally. Deolux makes the same thing because their technology has progressed.
Yeah.
So they can also produce the same and they can mix it for us exactly the color that we want.
So does it like have to be repainted every year?
No, it doesn't have to be repainted every year, but I think it should be repainted, say, every 3 to 5
okay.
years.
Yeah. Okay.
Because it's something that is not born into the product itself, it's something that you're applying. It needs maintenance.
Okay.
So, do you have construction workers walking along the top of the base, painting?
Yes, and under the base, putting up the scaffolding. And I have to do all of that logistics before I go. I have to not forget anything because there's no little shop around the corner.
How important do you think it is that South Africa has an Antarctic program, which can be quite expensive?
It's extremely important. For one, we've got, they measure seismic activity from the Antarctica at best. That's one. That kind of information for us and more. And I'm talking outside of my mandate. I'm talking of what it is there that you learn. And you go down and you meet different people and you realize that this information, having been gathered and sifted, it finds itself in archives within universities. Like yourself, doing a PhD. So that is important to me because I would like, and hence I've started the challenges so that, and people always referring, when is the next edition coming out, similar with you?
Yeah.
It doesn't stop your PhD. It goes on.
Oh, yeah.
Because we know that it's a mineral-rich environment, but that environment is also giving us information that tells us how the world is moving. So climate change, because the one thing that I've learned there, the biggest hole in the ozone layer is above the Antarctic. So that kind of study is happening there.
Yeah.
You know, we've been part of balloon shoot-ups for the Americans. So you find yourself, interestingly enough, part of exercises that tends to move you away from your mandate, but then you find an interest and you say, oh, what is this? The miners balloon campaign. Oh, okay, what is this about? Oh, no, we send balloons into different stratospheres or spheres of the atmosphere and we gather data and information to see about, and it's important for us to keep that all the time so that it is not lost and that there's always a future generation that can go and want to explore and research so that it benefits our country all the time.
What do you miss when you're down in Antarctica for 3 months or Marion for a month?
My family. But I tend to think about that when I get back onto the ship on my way back. Because I kind of switch it off when I leave. That's the only way I survive. Okay. When I leave here, the people on the ship becomes my family. People on the base become my family. And then I speak once a week to my family at home for 10 minutes, not longer. And all I want to know is if everything's okay. And then I put down the phone and that's it. And I go back to my family. Mm-hmm. And then when I get back on the ship, then I withdraw myself a bit and I say, I'm going to meet my family
again. And do you sometimes miss things about Antarctica when you're here in South Africa?
Yes.
What?
The one thing I miss a lot about Antarctica is when you're there, there is a great, great awareness of working together. Because people depend and need each other in that environment. When you put your foot down, you don't hear of that person again until the next time you go down.
Mm.
And we can be bombs if put together.
Mm.
You know, it's one of the sad things that all of that experience, be it in different fields, is just left to just go in their own directions. And I know you will be doing your PhD and you will be doing that and he'll be doing that, but there's no collective. So you know what I do. Like I believe the Australians have, they have a center where all of this comes together and they create a knowledge base for it. And from the knowledge base, like what I think you are intending to do, you're always, you can just go there and you'll find everything and anything on it. Now I know that SANEP has got a website, but I mean, we can improve and we can include more than what is currently being shown.
Mm-mm.
So that it benefits more.
Yeah.
The reason we don't have a big skills base is because this has not been shown to people. Why the president 2 years ago made a statement that the skills have left and it is still streaming out of our country in terms of artisans. Now I see an artisan in the same way I see a doctor or somebody who's got a doctorate. It's the same thing, but you haven't made it interestingly enough. People don't know that out there, even in Antarctica, you are able to go and exercise as an artisan.
Yeah.
It's not only scientists that need to go there, because you need to provide the infrastructure for them to be able to cope.
Scientists can't really live without the artisans at all.
Exactly. And I've realized that because we are the practical people putting together what they want us to put together. And I've realized that in the islands.
What do you think about the idea of a polar research institute?
Brilliant. It's overdue.
Well,
it's long overdue, and South Africa will play the most important part. You know why? We are the furthest south. Everyone has to stop here before they leave. So we need it. We need it more than ever because everyone stops here. I mean, the polar stern comes here. This is the last stop before they actually go down. So why not have an institute? Why not bring everything here and move it from here? And then we can have, if you're looking in terms of money, we will get that budgets back into our country. It's a revenue.
Because we'll I have to pay all the levies and what
have you. Thank you.
I should ask someone to inform me when the boat is the next comes, because I hear it's quite an impressive little ship.
It's an icebreaker. So it's got a massive, massive bar.
Are you going to try to be on the first journey south with the new South African ship?
If you say try, this is funny, because I'm now getting sick of what I'm doing. But if I tell people that, then they say, how can you? Because they've never been there. I've been doing it for too long. We need to broaden that skills base so that other people can now start doing it. And yes, it will most probably be, I won't be trying to get on. I'll most probably be going on to the new ship next year, if it's there. And so too, until if that ship goes and I'm still alive and I'm able to serve this industry, then I'll serve it.
So, if there's one thing you could change about the whole South African Antarctic program, what would it be?
Attitudes of people. They must realize that the program is so big and that we are thinking, but that's a typical South African mentality. We are the most critical of our sports players, our, you name it, whether it's a politician or a sports player, we are very critical, number one. But attitude in terms of this program, we don't realize the magnitude of it. We will talk about the Madrid Protocol, we will talk about the treaty that's been signed. to people across the world, that treaty has a certain amount of status that needs to be upheld. Whereas the South African gentleman comes in, and because of our past and we've been moving towards, what will you have my I want to do it the way I see it because I'm South African, man. Never mind the world, never mind the status. I'm just going to do it. So, yes.
But would you like to improve in the program, except for the attitude, in terms of logistics?
I'd like to see that all of the that you've got one program, and that it sticks to one program. Although we have different people adding towards the success of that one program, people think that their own success is the success of the program. Sometimes it will be to the detriment of another one, and they just don't mind and they don't care. We need to have that cross-functional teams working and saying, okay, fine, you being scientists and me realizing that you need a bit of practicality within your frame, you also need to realize that you need me.
Of course.
So because we all need each other, and not a matter of, that's what I need and that's it. If you don't want to give it to me, fine, I'll wait for another year to go and do it. That's not the attitude that you need to have. Because everyone needs to progress, and that is one program. So yes, I'd like to see it being one program only. And if the success of that program is determined, it will be determined by the collective and not by the individual or the groupings.
Two last questions. First is, how is it to work with scientists?
Brilliant. We can save the world. Brilliant. I'm somebody that I like to have deep conversations.
Yeah.
Very deep. So, and I read a lot my Quran. And my Quran tells me a lot about the world. And I cannot make out what it says because it's beyond me. The time for that to be revealed is not yet. But I find that with scientists, with their research that they do, like for instance, if I would talk to the oceanographers, I will tell them, do you know that if you go at certain depths into the ocean, that colors change? This color becomes that color.
Wow.
And they said, how do you know that? No, I say, I read the Quran, and the Quran tells me that. It says that that color becomes that color, and that you get salt and bitter, salt and bitter water on the one. Because the Quran says, I've let loose two flows of gushing water. The one is salt and bitter, and the one is sweet and can't get the word now. So that even is realized when I talk to them, and then they say, yeah, but you know, did you know that the oceans will never cross? That there will always be a line between them? I said, how do you know that? Because I get it in my Quran. And it says that. So now I get the practical when they're doing the tests and they're doing their research and they're putting stuff into the water and I'm talking to them, and now I realize that that is true.
Nice.
So for me, that's the brilliant part about interacting with scientists and scientific persons.
Okay. Do you find it's everything is sort of in a spirit of wanting to learning from one another?
Yes. Brilliant. In fact, with me, I'm busy reading a book called The Phenomenon of Nature in the Quran, which is about chemical properties and how we make up. We are part of the entire properties that is to be found on the earth. We are no different.
Interesting.
You know, and you are finding that, and then it takes you down to atoms, and that your entire makeup, if you look into this earth, therefore, that is where the saying comes from dust to dust, because that is what you are made from. So you are part of that entire chemical makeup. So I'm busy doing that so that I'm not waiting to prepare and see who's going to now engage with me on that. Oh, so that you can have that kind of discussion. So I kind of prepare myself. But that is what I had because that's what I find in this interesting. And if the trip is 26 days, then I have something to talk about every day to someone, and they can relate, and I can relate to it.
Good. And then a last question. Describe Antarctica.
Okay. If I'm going to describe it, I would like to say it's like this. You close your eyes, you take listament, and you put it into your mouth. And you goggle it for about 4 minutes. And that fresh part that just comes out, that's Antarctica. that whole, that ad that you see on the TV is like, that's enough.
Wonderful. Thank you. Do you have any questions? Oh, I have one last question. I don't know why it popped into my mind now. Do you ever have women construction workers going down?
I'm working on one now. They are very slow in entering, and we've had a slot, a one-hour slot in Alexandria Township on the radio. We were inviting women to enter into the construction. Although they're coming into construction, they are merely coming in at a management interview so that they can manage. But I would like to see, and I'm busy working on the first electrical person to be a woman from our workshops.
So you're trying to train the women so that they have the skills to be able to go?
Yes. You see, there's not all the trades that would be suitable for women. For instance, electrical, why not? And I feel that with women in the electrical field, I think that I will have an edge over the man. Because I think the women will just be a bit more, they will have more depth in the kind of study that they do, so that they can give me better feedback in terms of what it is that I can do better in Antarctica on there.
I hope more women get interested, because I also think it's something that...
There is another one that's entered but they're slow, man. They're slow. There has been previously. What happens is, once they realize that they're onto a certain field, it's a human nature. I look at what you earn, and I think that I want to earn what you earn. You don't look at where you are and how you can make where you are as comfortable in terms of earning as what you should be making it. So they look at that and they change field. They change course. And they say, okay, I've started out at becoming a plumber, but you know what, now that I've got my diploma, I need to go quickly. I want to move into that direction, because that...
They get advanced easier at the moment. Okay, thank you.
That's it.
Yes.
Thank you.